Okay, this is session number 10 with Robert Carr. It's December 28th, 2008, and we're now at about 1981-82 in Bob Carr's life, where he is returned to San Francisco, and he's opened a restaurant called Marvin Gardens, and he's beginning to get involved with U.G. Krishnamurti. In this period, U.G. gets his first TV interview. And that's a few years later. That might be 85, 86, Robert, or is this 83, 84 when the Jeffrey Mishlove show happens?
I'm not sure the date of it now.
Okay. All right. So we ended talking about that and what happened. But why was UG reluctant to be more well-known in the mass media?
Well, when he went through this physical change in 1967 in Switzerland, he told a few people what was happening to him, but he was reluctant to try to make anything out of it and organize it in any way. He felt that the whole, religious background that people have was preventing them from living in a more positive and efficient way of existence in their life. And so he was reluctant to start any kind of new fad religion, the Eugeism and all that. Although he did see people who came to see him, and that never... He never stopped people at the door. They were always welcome. And he was eager to talk about what had happened to him. And he felt that in the past, all these other religious people, they framed their experiences within the religious tradition, which was a mystical tradition explanation of what happened to them. And he felt that this became a block for people. It prevented them from going any further than a mystical interpretation. And he said what happened to him was purely physical. It had nothing to do with anything spiritual. Spirituality, he said, is a descriptive invention that humans created to try to describe what happened to the people they knew or they were in contact with, who they felt had achieved some special state of consciousness. And he wasn't saying that they didn't achieve that state of consciousness, but he said the description about it was an illusion, created an illusion, I should say. And he wanted to talk about his experience in pure physiological terms, because he said it is just a physical process that goes on. There's nothing spiritual about it. The whole idea of spirituality is another dimension, and he said that dimension doesn't exist. There is only the physical world that we live in. Anything else is a cultural interpretation that goes on. So he said it's purely physical what happened to him. The brain went through some kind of neurological change, chemical neurological change. Now today in modern brain research, they're discovering that all these states that people talk about that they achieve through meditation are related to brain functions, that certain parts of the brain create these kind of experiences. And so Yuji was therefore reluctant to make a religious cult out of what happened to him. He just wanted to talk about it in terms of that it's a physical event. That's all there is just this physical world that we live in, nothing else. And so he was didn't want to talk about it in the mystical terms that J.K. did and other religious teachers in the past, and so forth. So he was bent on just destroying that approach by talking about it in just ordinary layman's language. Nothing special.
Okay Robert, Robert, just stand back from the microphone slightly. I think you're okay. Popping a bit. Okay. And so why did he even talk about it? You know, even to small groups. What was the context? Since he thought it was important on some in some level.
Yeah, obviously, yeah. That, I mean, you know, this is a question we have to answer ourselves. It's our own personal question. You know, why do we talk? Why do we communicate with others? Why do we have this urgent need or feeling to want to communicate? You know, we're social, you know, creatures, animals, you know. We develop this social aspect to us. I've tried to understand this myself in my own life, why I talk to other people. I only do it when I see that there's some pain in another person, some structure they're doing that's causing them a pain in their life that they can't function properly. They're screwed up, and so then I have the urge to sit, to just point out maybe what's keeping them from functioning in a more clear way. So I think UG has a compassionate nature, very strong compassion, and where that compassion comes from, you know, if when you talk about compassion, you get caught up in the religious terminology, and so it's very difficult to undo that structure of thought that we have, that is the interpretive structure around, built up around experiences and so forth that people have. I think Eugene feels the pain and suffering of the world, of people in the world, how the world is in a horrible mess, terrible mess it's in, and that in a certain sense there's no way to undo that mess by any new approach. That all we can do is perhaps free ourselves from what makes the mess, and in that sense we become less involved in the structure that's preventing a sane life that we can live. So I think when someone comes to him and says, my life is this, my life is that, my wife is leaving me, I have a cancer, what do I do? His response is to point out what's keeping that person from functioning, you know, in a more sane way. So I think I said enough on that. That's his response. You ask him a question, and as a human, he responds. But his response is always to try to undo, unravel the cause of your concern, and to point out that concern perhaps is false. You don't need that concern. It's something inherited as part of our cultural background. So he attacks the mystical religious symbolism that human beings have evolved in their search to try to find out the answers to their life, to what life's all about. Is there such a thing as God? If not, then what is there? You see, we're trapped in this cultural language that we have. And God and reality and truth and beauty and compassion and the meaning of existence, what the hell's going on? It's all part of that cultural background. And so I can't think or talk without it. It's there. It's part of me. So his interest, if he has an interest at all, what is to try to undo that, unravel, point out that this is false, that it doesn't lead anywhere. It just goes, it's just a merry-go-round, and we're caught, and we can't get off, and there's no way to get off, and we go round and round and round and round, and that continues to have a momentum that grows and grows and becomes stronger and stronger and projects itself into the future, conditions. So human beings are trapped on this wheel. This is probably what the Buddha was talking about, and what other mystics in the past. But unfortunately, what they said got translated and became false.
Yeah. Now, what was the meaning of the cataclysm? Was the cataclysm he had in 67 him waking up to all that you've just said that he represented?
What happened to him, he said that thought came to an end. It stopped. He broke the chain of how we think. One thought related to the next thought, to the next thought. And that continuance of thought creates this sense of separateness. It creates me, I, my thought, my experience, you. And that is the problem. That's the tragedy of mankind.
I wonder how he would have handled it if he didn't have Valentine.
Something would have happened, you know. She had a part to play, no doubt.
But something else, like physiologically he changed from this. That's what people say, you know. He physically changed.
He physically went through physical changes. Bodily changes, you know.
And then he tried to say that it wasn't significant.
Well, he didn't want to make a big production out of it, we'll put it that way.
But okay,
it happened to him.
And but it was significant.
Yeah, that's not going to happen to you the way it happened to him, because whenever this happens, it's different.
Right. I don't know. Maybe he is the only mystic who played down the experience. Maybe.
Yeah. Others have done it. Others have done it in India, and in the past. But unfortunately, what they said eventually got institutionalized. Right across outside my window is a Jain temple, and the Jains were an offshoot of Buddhism. In fact, some scholars think that maybe the Jain adept Mahavira was Buddha. They were the same man.
Mm-hmm.
Tradition got split anyway. Or as Yuji points out, he says they come in twos.
Okay. So the thing is that something happened to him personally. He changed. Other people noticed it, and then he had to deal with the effect of that on people. I mean, he would sort of make a significance out of it to those that asked him about it. But he would say it has nothing to do with. It was significant for him, but not for anybody else. And right. people would witness this charismatic vibration coming off him and want to know what it was and that, and he would argue with their interpretation of that. And that's... he continued to live with that stigma of having this vibrational effect on people. And he accepted that effect. He accepted that effect on people, but kept it on a minimum. So then the media comes along and... You said that he was only going to do 12, but he does more?
Yeah, he does a lot of different... I don't know how many he did. You can go online and search it out. But he was always saying, I will do 12 of these, you know, or 8 of that, you know, just kind of making these statements. It's kind of... I don't know where it came from. But anyway, he said he would do 12. So this first one with Mishla was the first the first video, you know, the television program. He did some filming with a guy named Pablo, a Italian friend who tried to make a documentary and didn't succeed. And several people have tried to make documentaries of his life, and it ends up on the floor.
So why?
Mahesh even tried. It's impossible.
Well, UG made it hard to do?
The very nature is that he's talking about is it destroys. It's destructive.
Yeah, I mean, people could film him, and they could go and look up his past and interview people. They could do that. But there was a certain point there he would sabotage it?
No, not personally. Just there's a fellow right now in New York who I've been in contact with, and other people. He's been in contact with other friends of UG, and he's trying to put together material now to make a documentary on UG, and people are giving him tape and helping him, and I've invited him to come to India and stay here and research and do the Indian research here, and have access to my files, my videotape, and so forth. So I maybe he'll do it. We'll see. He's struggling to do it. He's getting a lot of help from people.
Did Mahesh Bhatt try to make one?
He started, but then he said it was impossible.
Now, what do you think? I don't see how it could be impossible. You're not saying that UG caused problems with these people. They just maybe
When someone says, "What does UG say?" it's very difficult because he doesn't say anything. You know, that's lineal. You know, it's what he says is what he's attacking your question.
Okay, maybe
what he says normally is just gossip, the day by day things that we do. You know. He goes to the store, buys some yogurt, buys a plane ticket, wants to go get some chocolates, wants to go for a ride. You know, just let's go to France today. Come on, let's go. You know, we're all piling the cars and drive off to France and drive around for all day long. And that's what he does. You know, that's his life. It's very simple. So he doesn't say anything like blah blah blah. God is X Y Z. You know, he doesn't say anything. But if you say something to him, what about this? Then he what he says to you is, "Why are you asking that silly question?"
You know? Okay, maybe you're the best one to explain it. It seems the filmmaker needed to. Except show footage of him talking with people, then have people say, "I don't know what he's talking about, I hang around, we do this," and say what you kind of do, and accept that. It's almost like the filmmaker has a problem, he's trying to put significance in it, and to the degree he puts significance, he gets frustrated.
How do you present UG when he is he negates every statement he makes? Whatever he says, the next statement is a negation of that previous statement.
Okay,
yeah,
I would see
nothing left. There's nothing there.
There's no problem in presenting that. I mean, I think most people probably project.
No, I know it can be done. Of course, there's a book out by Mukesh Rao in Bangalore, who's done a very nice book on UG's life, and Mahesh wrote a book on UG's life. And the books are there. So, a documentary can be made, but it'll be about UG. When he was 7 years old, this happened, blah, blah, blah. And when he met JK, he wasn't impressed. Or, you know, it'll be this statements and ideas. And the problem is that as you present him, you get stuck in this bracket of religious terminology. Because that's the only terms, it's the only verbal words we have that talks about this.
Yeah, what you should do is the filmmaker should have you complaining about the movie as part of the movie. See, you know, I mean, I could do it, but we're doing it now with you. I think you're the hidden ground of all this stuff. So let's make the movie on Bob Carr. And Bobcat complained all the way through it and showed footage of Krishnamurti, both of them, and refute them or make fun of them. You know, that's the way to do it. Focus on someone who came out of America and did all these things before, actually laid down a lot of patterns at the counterculture and media obsession that happened, and restaurant making, all this stuff that you did. Have that as the ground of UG. You created UG. And yeah. Then have you deny it all the way through the document? You deny it and say, look, pay more attention to UG. Then we have UG saying, don't pay any attention to me. It would be funny.
In Bangalore, he went to Bangalore, I don't know, 3 or 4 years after the calamity, and he gave a talk, public talk, and he described in quite in detail what happened to him and how he functions as a individual. And then after that, he said, I'm not going to give any more public talks.
That was it.
One talk was enough. What he said was extremely clear and precise. And he didn't need to say anything after that. If you listen to him, you find that he just repeats one statement after the other. Because if you ask him, he'll say that's all that's there. It's just all these tapes.
Was that tape? Was that talk taped?
Yeah.
So we can hear the one speech, yeah. the one serious yeah. talk, and then that was it. And yeah. Would you think he was doing it for people who knew a bit about him? He was explaining himself to people from his past? Is that who was in the audience? Why was there any audience?
I think he was trying to make a statement, you know, what happened to him. So,
but who was he doing it for?
Every individual expresses something. You express Bob Dobbs.
Yeah,
I express what I am. UG was expressing, you know, whatever and what, and when this happened, whatever happened to him, whatever is there operating in him is expressing itself. So,
right, but well, who was the audience for that special taped?
It was session? College audience, pundits, learned people, college students, you know, professors.
Had they heard of him before?
Probably some of them knew of him, but not very.
But he sort of made sure that there was an audience there. He drummed up attention to himself.
Well, someone organized it. Right. He didn't organize it.
Because he was not special till he had the cataclysm, but then he did for a couple years have the effect of having the cataclysm, so he got a bit of attention, so then he had to make a speech.
He was known. He used to be a part of the Theosophical Society. He was a lecturer for the society, member, and for a number of years he traveled in Europe and India giving talks on the Theosophical jargon. Yeah. So then later that ended. He couldn't do it anymore. It was all too silly, he thought. So there was a bug up his ass, you know, about everything. And that bug had to get, you know, had to express itself.
Right, right. Okay, so he was reluctant to do media because he didn't want it spread. He didn't want his story spread.
He didn't want to become an icon, you know.
That was it.
He didn't want to become an icon.
He wanted to be a guru on the human scale for those that thought he was a guru, and he'd try to get rid of them as soon as possible, or he'd be sympathetic and talk with them all day. And you have lots of tape of that.
Yeah, we can put it this way. There is such a thing as a real person. You can call him a guru, a real guru. And he tells you, I can't help you. There's nothing I can do for you. You have to do the work. All I can say is the door is over there. Go open it. That's all. So, in the classical sense, that's what a guru is. But what happens is that the guru became translated into all these phony babas and phony religious teachers who are just making a business out of it. That's all they're doing. It's just a business for them. They won't admit that because they're too phony. But that's all it is. It's just a business to make money and to get laid. It's an easy lay.
Mm.
You can have all the pretty girls come to you and want to be laid by the guru.
What do you personally think of the Pope, present Pope?
What Pope?
The Pope of the Roman Catholic Church.
What do I think?
Yeah.
What I think doesn't make any difference at all. He's just another political, political. It's just a political office he's in. That's all it is. It has nothing to do with spirituality. It's just politics. It's just protecting the interest of the church. He's a protector of the church, which is all this stagnated garbage.
Stagnated, that's a good word. Stagnated garbage.
Yeah, garbage. It should be thrown out, but they won't, because it's a means of a livelihood for these people. Of prestige, power, money. You know, he's the Pope. So, what the hell? What's that? Nothing.
What if you were in the same room as him in some social situation, would you pay your respect to him? Would you respect him? Would you
as a human being, but not as some pontiff?
Right. And well, if you said as a human being, would you respect what that human being does?
It is what it is. I can't change it.
So you'd be around him as little as possible if you were in the same room with him.
Right. I wouldn't say anything, you son of a, or anything like that.
You wouldn't throw your shoe at him.
No. He deserves it.
He deserves it, though.
He deserves more than a shoe.
Okay, so do you believe what Eugene probably never even talked about it, but what would he think of Trotskyists running around protesting, or the people who stormed the embassy today in the Israeli embassy in London? That's a collective action. What do you think of that kind of political stuff, or did he ever mention that?
Probably be on the side of the terrorist.
He would agree with the Al-Qaeda.
Probably, yeah.
But he wouldn't make that a major point of his discussion, I guess.
Look, Bob. The whole structure of the world is contaminated. It's a filthy mess. Every government, every country, every monarch, every structure that's running the world, or running the country, running the organization, running whatever it is they're running, is polluted. And so the terrorists are only wanting to get what the other people have. They want the refrigerators, the cars. They want the atom bomb. They want, they want what you have.
Right. And they want more. They want into the mess.
They want to be part of the mess too,
yeah.
They want to control it. They want to be the president, the new prime minister, the new general, the new pope, the new this, They want.
And you look at this and say, well, what degree, this would be what everybody thinks too, probably, or what thought thinks. Thought says, this has gone on for centuries. It'll probably continue going on. Yeah. I'm going to get myself in a position where I don't have to deal with it too much. Yeah. And that's about it. That's the thought you have. It's the thought I have. The thought everybody has, right?
We have to survive. And it's not possible to survive without exploiting in some way.
Yeah.
Because our whole structure is based on that.
Yeah, we talked about this before. You actually think, humanity probably will destroy itself. I think that's your thought, or the thought that you foreground that comes into you from the thought archive, right?
Well, there's two thoughts you have. Right? Man is destroying himself. The other thought is, somehow he'll save himself.
It's the two thoughts, yep.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, so let's go into... UG does get broadcast, but he keeps it on a small scale. Those broadcasts don't go too far. Not a lot of people see them, really, right? A few people see them.
When UG was in Mill Valley, at the first house he was living in, can you hold the line? Someone just came to the door. Let me just check with you.
Yeah.
In the house, in the first house that UG was staying in Mill Valley, that Terry arranged, one day Paul and I decided to tape him. I had bought a video camera, Panasonic camera, and so we went over there and said, UG, will you let us tape a conversation? And he said, okay, all right. And there was a fellow who was a religious teacher of sorts, came to see UG, and we asked him, do you mind if we tape you? I think his name was Danny something. He was he'd listened to Krishnamurti and was paraphrasing Krishnamurti. And he had a little sect going, a little cult going in San Anselmo in Marin County there. So the first thing he sat in front of the Venetian blinds. They were closed, but it was a big lot of light, you know, very bright. So I asked him, I told him that it would be better if he was sat in a different place, and he said no, he wouldn't want to sit there. I said, okay. So he was silhouetted because of the bright light behind him. And, Danny Castro was the guy's name. And so anyway... Danny Castro was asking questions, and UG was blasting, you know. And this was one of the first tape that was ever made. But when I said UG makes it very difficult to do anything, he's a silhouette, you know. At that time, the video cameras weren't so hot. They weren't as good as they are now. So, you don't see his features. You just see his outline, his black blob there shouting at Danny Castro. But that was... perhaps one of the first tapes that was done. And then we did another one in Mill Valley, in Sausalito, where he was staying in another house. And I brought the same camera over, and I recorded maybe about an hour of Narimurti, Clark Higgins, who works for Lucasfilm, and Terry Newland, who wrote the book Thought Is Your Enemy, and a long, long time friend of UG. I taped the three of them talking together, and that's some of that material is on the web now. It's on the UG site, and so he got used to the idea of maybe video wasn't so bad after all. Although I don't think he ever looked at it. He had no interest in anything at all. As a means of promotion or a means of explaining, he's just a little bit curious about things, and that was all. So then after that, other people started to begin to tape. Douglas did some taping, and we continued the following year to do more taping, and that got UG, videotaping is not so horrible, and so that led to the Mishlev tape. So then after that, he did some taping in New York and Europe and Albuquerque, New Mexico. A television station there interviewed him one day. Larry Morris had arranged it. Larry Morris is a minister, and he has a church there in Albuquerque, and UG was a guest of Larry. And Larry was... kind of a new ager, new age church, and which is still running. As far as I know, he's still talking. But and why, I don't know. But this is Larry's thing. So,
right. It's in the Christian context, a new age Christian church?
Yeah. It's very new agey. And Larry got very interested in UG and devastated by UG, and followed him to Europe, and every year he was there listening to him. And still going on with this church, because he said, this is the only way I have to make a living. I can't make a living any other way. And it's right. The easiest way for me to make a living. And of course, Yuji would say, well, what you are is the most detestable, most disgusting, person. Religious people are the most disgusting bastards in the world. Larry would say, yes. But go on, never changing, never walking out.
Okay, so in this period in the 80s, at the restaurant and your life there at Marvin Gardens, besides UG, there were all these other new cult figures like Andrew Cohen, and you list them at the end of your book, these various people. I think it begins with Ram Dass. He comes across your porch.
Ram Dass was a friend of a fellow named Kelly who was been injured in a baseball accident when he was a young boy, and he was confined to a wheelchair and couldn't talk. Somehow Kelly was looking for answers to how to get out of the situation he's in, and so he was studying spirituality, and he met Ram Dass, and they became friends sort of in some strange way. And so Kelly used to come to the restaurant all the time because he knew Paul, because Paul and his brother worked for him for a number of years when Paul was younger, and Paul's brother was a provider, a helper for Kelly. And so Kelly asked if we wanted to meet Ram Dass, and I said, sure, why not? I went to hear one of his talks gathering at a school gymnasium someplace, and I had read Be Here Now, and I knew a little bit about Larry and Ram Dass, and they were in the media and so forth, but I just felt the whole thing was a show. It was an entertainment for people. They had some folk singers and chanting and stories of India, and it was all very nice and sweet, but it's just an entertainment, So I wasn't really impressed at all. But who am I to be impressed? But anyway, Ram Dass came for lunch one day, and I went over and introduced myself, and then he had heard of UG, and I think he had read one of the books. Not mine is a myth, probably. So he said, he would like to meet him. He was curious and so forth. So I said, okay, I can arrange it for you. And I got his telephone number or something. So then I mentioned to UG, and he said, if he wants to, he doesn't care. He said, but arrange it at my house, he said, the meeting. And he asked that Terry and Krim and Paul and I be there for the meeting. And we asked him why, and he said, well, I need your help, he said. He always said, I need your help. So, anyway, we arranged a meeting, and Ram Dass came, and he drove up in his little sports car, came in, UG was there, and after a few, few minutes of niceties, and hello, how are you, and so forth, UG talked to him, told him a little bit about himself, what happened to him, and I don't know if Albert Ram Dass, got it clearly. But he did ask him a couple of interesting questions. One of them was that, can this state, reality, truth, God, whatever you want to call it, can it be experienced? And Yuji said no. So that disappointed Ram Dass, because he was hopeful that that these experiences that other people talk about were meaningful, that they were describing reality. What Yuji said that they were describing were the experiences of others.
He was asking if he could experience Yuji's particular experience?
He was asking whether you could, anyone could experience reality. And Yuji said it's not possible. And he went on to explain why it wasn't. He pointed out why it couldn't be experienced.
So, but what we do experience is not reality or God.
What we do experience are the experiences that others have talked about.
Right. It's like the Eskimo says, how can I know stone without the word stone? So language is the way we experience things. And language was made long before us, and we're just living inside the language.
Put it this way. Somebody experienced what they called the truth, the reality. It blew them out, blew their circuits out. And so they started to talk about what happened to them, and people begin to listen to them. And as people listen to them, they develop a language, a description, just like what we're doing now.
Yeah.
Okay? Same thing, exactly.
Yeah.
They create a description. And that becomes part of our culture. And that is part of our memory. It's located in the memory vault. We'll call it that. Hmm? So when one steps out of themselves momentarily, one of those experiences takes place that happens to that did happen to another, because I use the descriptive process to explain it to myself, and that becomes, you know, it's just a description. Okay, I'll put it this way. I experienced what I felt was reality. And then what's there? There's a description that goes on. It was this. It was awe-inspiring. It was infinite. It was beyond comprehension, beyond the grasp of my intellectual process of thinking. It was something that so devastating. You know, it goes on and on and on like that. So that's what happens. So that becomes part of the residue in memory, in consciousness, that everyone has access to and is percolating in your own consciousness right now. So if you take LSD or some other psychotropic substance, or because of the brain chemistry you fall into this state, then you experience that state, that memory, and you say, ah, I've experienced reality. You haven't. You've experienced a description of reality. That's all. Got it?
Yeah, I would say it's richer than description. You experience language. So humans are language, and the new media are new languages, and we're happy we got them, and we're experiencing like hell. It's just that you can't sum it up.
And language is very important for when it says, how much is that apple?
Yeah,
we have to have it.
And we don't. We're not taught that language contains all the cultures and all the languages anybody ever thought or dreamt.
Everything.
Yeah. And so rather than saying it's an Akashic record, some ethereal place, it's right here in the language in English. Or in,
yes, it's right in the brain cells. Each cell.
Yeah. Oh, there's the phone. It's right in the telephone.
Hello. Yeah, can I call you back because I'm on the telephone, okay?
Yeah. Yeah, you just told that person you were engaged in language. I can't language you. I'm language with someone else. We're on Skype.
Right. So
this this is what James Joyce showed in Finding His Wake. So it's interesting about the book. See, he shows all thought and ideas, past, present, future, are in there, in the language, but he doesn't just create out of the spoken word. He uses the new media as languages. That is what UG failed to talk about. he kept staying within the religious terminology and specialized in that effect. And
well, because the people who came to see him, that's what they talked about.
Right, and you used to, right, but he would watch Madonna and other things with you when he wasn't in that role, right?
Yeah.
He was enjoying the new language.
Yeah. Yeah. He liked Boy George.
Okay.
Anything different he liked.
Right. You were talking about, okay, so Ram Dass asked a good question, and what more happened in their encounter?
Well, Yuji explained to him, you know, the whole process, why it's not possible. And I don't think Ram Dass, you know, wanted to hear that. And after a while, after talking for over an hour and a half, Ram Dass excused himself and left. And I only saw him a few times after that. He didn't. Yuji would be a threat to a person like Ram Dass unless they had the guts, you know, to follow through and free themselves from pretending to be someone who knows something.
So Ram Dass never talked about it again whenever you encountered him?
No, I saw him a few times. I saw him in a video shop, and I saw him in a restaurant and with his friends around him. But I never really talked to him after that. A little bit. Niceties, you know.
Right.
He was curious a little bit about me, but we didn't have anything in common, you know, really. A little bit, but
yeah,
I would have been a threat to him also. Because I didn't buy anything.
Right.
I wasn't buying what he said was selling. He was selling Guru Ram Dass, you know.
That's right. Now, we've interviewed Gerd Stern, and he knew Ram Dass through the years, way back there. And he says that Ram Dass is a scum. He has no respect for him at all. So Gerd had the same idea.
I wouldn't call him scum, but he's desperate to be recognized, he wants to be a, you know, the rabbi. That's what his program is. He's Rabbi Ram Dass.
Right. Now, another guy that came into your life in that period was Andrew Cohen, who has this magazine. Have you seen his magazine, What is Enlightenment?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he
went... I never met Andrew Cohen at all. I saw him on television, and Julie Thayer and some other people that later left him and came over to Yuji's camp told me all their stories about how he was running their life, and I know an attorney in Marin who was quite involved with Andrew, and so I know all the stories, and I met an author of a book that What is Enlightenment, a Dutch fellow who has written an interesting book on his trip with Andrew Cohen, and you know. But
yeah, you talk about Andrew's mother encounters Yuji.
Oh, yeah. I met his mother. She became a friend of Yuji. I told that story to you before about how Julie and Leslie and Andrew's mother and Jerry Rossi came to see Yuji in Mill Valley, and within 20 minutes he freed them from their attachment to
her son.
To Andrew, yeah. Julie said to him, do we need a guru to help us? And Yuji's answer was, why do we need a guru? If we fall down, we just pick ourselves up and continue to walk. And that ended it. They all saw. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the word. It wasn't the G-U-R-U, you know. It was what was behind it. It had an impact on them. It was the consciousness behind those words that it blew them out. And they saw, why do I need a guru?
Yeah, for some reason he had weight in his speech. He had
something there. It was
power that that actually got to people. They actually listened and oh, something stuck in their brains on what he had just
there's
said.
There's something behind the word, not the word. Yeah. Something behind. The other fellows just have the word and nothing behind it.
Mm.
It's just an intellectual. That's all. It's just
Ram
Dass is just an intellectual person. That's all. Pretending to be spiritual for his own self-satisfaction. Sorry, Mr. Alpert, Dr. Alpert.
What went on at Marvin Gardens? What was it like managing it, and what did you think of?
You know, the business. You know, the business is fraught with problems and everything, and it was fun and difficult and hard, and I had some fantasy that I wanted to have a restaurant of my own, and I had 12 years of it, and that was enough. But it was a very interesting process to go through. I call it a process because I have to give it a name of some kind. But it was a way of making a living, and I discovered I liked cooking and creating a menu and so forth, and teaching other people and getting something to work. Making it happen. It was a popular restaurant in Marin.